Just a moment, I will turn services over to Dr. Steve Wages. Dr. Wages is not only a professor at Fulton University, but he is the director of Cloverdale Center for Youth and Family Ministries. Dr. Wages and his sweet wife, Wanda, are here with us this morning. I have come to know, Justin and I both come to know and love Dr. Wages through our schooling, our master's program at Fulton University, where we are working on a Christian counseling and marriage and family degree. Dr. Wages has been a professor of ours in a couple of the semesters we've been there, and he is just a phenomenal human being. For those of us who are in Bible class, you know how great he is already. What a great job he has already done. And listen, someone come up to him and said, "Have you written a book?" He said, "No, but I agree. He needs to write one, doesn't he?" He is a great man. I love him dearly, and you and I are going to be in for a treat as he comes and talks to us about marriages.
Okay. Thank you, Terry, for that introduction. Hey, I'm excited to be here today. I commend the elders and Terry and Justin for this series of lessons that's been going on for 3 or 4 weeks, focused on strengthening our marriages and families. Commend the elders and ministers and leading in that. I know they care deeply about your marriage, about your family, your children, and you are blessed by your elders, by Terry and Justin and others here. I'm so thankful to be here. And I'm quite humbled by that introduction, which causes me to remind you from our Bible class, I suggested to you that, hey, I've made enough mistakes to train everybody here. And it's by the grace of God and a good wife that I stand before you here today. In our Bible class, we said that marriage and family life is a place of spiritual warfare. You don't get married and the devil leaves you alone. You don't bring children into this world and the devil leaves them alone. We're in a raging battle for the hearts and minds of our children that begins at their cradle and will never end this side of my grave. And we are in a raging battle for the sanctity of our marriages that begins at the altar and should never end this side of eternity. Amen? And so I appreciate this opportunity. We looked at we said in Bible class that I have a curiosity about how couples choose one another, and I also have a curiosity about how couples over time will grow apart. Isn't it amazing that couples who pledge their love for one another over 5 years, 7 years, 10 years, they grow apart over time? So I have a real curiosity about what factors contribute to couples growing apart over time. It is spiritual warfare. The devil is scheming. He's looking to drive a wedge between you and your spouse, between you and your children, and in the resulting turmoil of it all, to undermine the faith of everyone involved. And that's why we're dedicating this series and this day to marriages and families. So during Bible class, I mentioned to you two factors. The familiarity factor, it's not new anymore. The delightful becomes ordinary. The enchanting becomes routine. We just get too comfortable. We take one another for granted. I mentioned to you the fatigue factor. It's not pressing anymore. There was a time when winning Wanda's love was at the top of my to-do list. I checked that off my to-do list. And we come to invest ourselves in many other pursuits. And if we're not careful, we'll lose our marriage and our family along the way. So we want to pick up here in our worship hour with the third factor that I believe contributes to couples growing apart over time. I call it, give me just a moment here. We ended up at the beginning. Give me just a moment. Hey, we're getting close, I think. Or if you guys can do it faster up there, I'll be at slide 40. Oh my. Slide 40. Yeah, okay. We're doing battle here. Slide 40, I think it is. The flaw factor. I think they can do it. I'll go on without it. How about that? We're incredibly flawed. The flaw factor. It's not easy. Looking back on it, I would suggest to you that dating and courtship is actually an artificial environment to evaluate a relationship. Because we have a tendency to put our best foot forward when we're in dating and courtship, you know what I mean by that. If you're not careful, there's a certain amount of unintentional deception in the process. Sometimes there can be some intentional deception in dating and courtship. And if you're not careful, watch this, you will fail to discover his or her less than best self. There was a preacher who said, who did the wedding ceremony of a couple, and they were married for about a year, and the young groom came back to the preacher and was talking about how difficult the first year had been, and they talked and visited for about an hour, and the young groom gets up to leave the meeting, and as he does, the preacher looked at him and says, "Hey, you remember you took her for better or worse." The young groom turned to the preacher and said, "Yes, but she turned out to be worse than I took her to be." There's some humor in that, but there's also some truth in that. Oh, your marriage soon encounters the flaw factor. It's not easy. In fact, it is harder than what you thought it would be. You vow to love them unconditionally, but you don't know just how imperfect he or she is. In fact, you soon discover that marriage involves two imperfect people entering into a committed relationship, diligently pursuing intimacy under the rule of God. You see, mine is an imperfect love for Wanda. And Wanda's is an imperfect love for me. You discover that you have different sin natures, that spiritual warfare began in the garden, and it is alive and well today. For example, the story of Adam and Rebecca. Adam was her knight in shining armor, a good and godly man, no doubt. But I remember being home one evening and getting a phone call from Adam, and he says, "Hey, could you come over? We need to talk." And I'm like, "What's up?" And he says, "Just come over. We need to talk." And so I make my way over to their apartment and I knock on the door, and as I enter their apartment, Adam begins to sob. And in a few moments, I recognized that their marriage had just come face to face with spiritual warfare. Spiritual warfare which began in the garden and is alive and well today. As Adam shared with me how Rebecca had just discovered he had been visiting some explicit sites on the internet, and you know exactly what I'm talking about, and their marriage has just come face to face with spiritual warfare. What would you say when she is hurt, when she feels betrayed, when he feels broken in the moment? What would you say in that moment when their marriage has just come face to face with the flaw factor? It's not easy. Before I tell you what I shared with them, let me say a bit also that women can be hurtful too. We had some good friends of ours years ago that married, and they had two daughters, and he was a good and godly man in my eyes, but I would say to you that he was the recipient of constant ridicule and criticism, oftentimes clothed in jest, oftentimes clothed in joking. He was the recipient of constant ridicule and criticism from his wife and two daughters. What O'Donnell and Morris described this way: many men take injury upon injury from their wives and children and just hide the blood. They quickly cover the wounds from sight of others, but the painful injuries do not disappear simply because they are hidden. If anything, they fester and grow deeper as more jabs and punches are aimed at their unhealed wounds. I'm going to suggest to you that there are many men out there who think there was a time when maybe they were vulnerable, maybe where they shared their hearts and they paid a price for it. Perhaps they were ridiculed or they were questioned or somehow they were made to look small. And I'm going to tell you that man will think twice and a third time before he shares his heart again. Your children will not most likely survive the well-intended blunders of your husband's parenting. But they will not do well with a father who backs away from his parenting responsibilities because he cannot do it well enough to satisfy you. Similarly, your marriage will likely survive your husband's well-intended marital blunders, but your marriage will not survive the husband who disengages from you because he can never do it good enough. Oh, O'Donnell and Morris go on and describe it this way. One man said that taking the role of spiritual leadership for his wife equates for him with standing to speak in front of a large audience with no pants on. Why? Because his wife knows all his failures, all his weaknesses, and as he said, seems to have a special gland that helps her recall these failures in an instant when I fail again. Therefore, why try to change the status quo? Why risk ridicule or lack of support from your wife and possibly even our children? Oh, we can see a part of us that can be easily crushed. And of all the people in this world, who knows better than a man's wife how to crush his heart? Oh, man, you can be hurtful to your wife, to your children. You have it in you to be an incredible influence for good in their lives, or you have it within you to do unspeakable harm. But I would say to the women as well, your influence is not neutral either. In fact, it's often a man's own wife whose arrows hold the most potent poison because she knows his biggest weaknesses and is close enough to take perfect aim. See, to the women, your influence is not neutral either. You have it within you to encourage him, to enhance him, to strengthen him in his spiritual leadership and marriage and family, or you have it within you to defeat him. In fact, they go on to say, you hold the words of life for your husband, even if he seems nonchalant about your feelings, even if he doesn't seem concerned about your approval, he is. He just doesn't know how to admit it without feeling overly vulnerable. It's the flaw factor. It's not easy. We husbands have it within us to do great harm and injury, but wives do too. I like this quote. When we expect perfection out of marriage, we are setting ourselves up for disaster. Marriage means tortuous work and a predictable routine. That's what you should expect. Indeed, a successful marriage has little to do with sustained bliss and everything to do with surrendering to the grind. Oh, I hope that's at least a little bit of an overstatement. I hope that's a little bit of a hyperbole. But you know what I mean by the flaw factor. It's not easy. Your spouse may be the one who hurts you the most. someday. So, what would be our brick, our strategy for dealing with the flaw factor? Well, it's forgiveness. Let's talk about forgiveness. I believe that marriage is made up of two good givers and two good what? Four givers. If you want to remodel your marriage, if you need to rebuild your marriage, it usually begins with forgiveness. But you might say, well, how do you forgive when you've been hurt so deeply? How do you forgive when you have been wounded? How do you forgive when you have been betrayed or hurt in profound ways? What if I put it this way? How do you forgive the unforgivable? How do you love the unlovable? How do you do that? And as I've pondered that over the years, the question, where do you find the power? I mean the strength to forgive the unforgivable, to love the unlovable. I'm often reminded that Jesus was crucified by those who were supposed to love Him the most. Jesus was nailed to a cross by His own people, the people who were supposed to love Him the most. And it may very well be your spouse one day who nails you to a cross. It may very well be one of your children one day who betrays you and hurts you most deeply. Where do you find the power to forgive those who should have loved you the most? And I'm going to suggest to you, I know of only one place you find the power to forgive the unforgivable and the power to love the unlovable, and it is in your own personal identification with the cross as a believer. Look at Luke 9:23. Then He said to them, if anyone would come after Me, he must deny himself, take up his cross, and follow Me. I'm here to tell you, I don't mind being a Christian. I just don't like being crucified. And it may very well be your spouse or your children who nail you to a cross one day. Where do you find the power to forgive, to love the unlovable? And I know of only one place, and it's in words that are spoken from a cross, where Jesus stretched forth His hands and He says, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. And there may come a time for some of you when you have to stretch forth your hands in your own personal identification with the cross. Say, Father, forgive them. They know not what they do. So as I walked into the room, that the apartment that evening, I read to them this quote. Can I devote myself to a person who is far from perfect, but who wants to share a common life with me? Will I choose to love a person because he is perfect or because he is through and through who he is? Real devotion begins the day I accept my husband, my wife, as a wonderful, lovable sinner. Oh, there's no question that we had to deal with the issue at hand, the struggle at hand, because it indeed would be destructive to his marriage. But where do they find the power to forgive? I suggest it's in words spoken from a cross. I have written in my Bible, if God can save me by grace, I can live with Wanda by grace. If God can extend His grace to me, I can extend my grace to her, and she can extend her grace to me, and I've been the recipient and blessed by her extension of grace. Someone says, do you forgive and forget, like the book title suggest, and I say, no, I don't want to forget because I never want to go there again. However, if I forgive, I can act as though I have forgotten, that I have nailed it to a cross. So in an application of this point, I would suggest to you this week, can you pray for the ability to acknowledge our wrongs and to both ask and extend forgiveness. If I was talking more about conflict resolution and such, which I don't have time for today, I would say, let me be the first to say I was wrong. Let me be the first to say I am sorry. Let me be willing to say I forgive. Brick number 8 for us is commitment. Oh, in the face of the fall factor, it's not easy. We must look at commitment. Perhaps you know the story of Sir Hernando Cortez, who led a Spanish expedition down to South America. He was looking for golden treasure, right? He had like 5 ships and men and supplies, and they were going to go into the interior and look for golden treasure. And if you remember the story, they took all the supplies off the ship, and Sir Hernando Cortez knew something about the journey they were taking. He knew that they were going to the interior, they would be ambushed by the natives along the way, that some of his men would get sick with malaria and fever and would die along the way, and before long they would be saying, let's turn and sail towards home. Let's turn back. And if you know the story as it goes, they unloaded the ships and supplies on the shore, and then he gave his command, burn the ships. You see, Sir Hernando Cortez defined commitment this way. You limit your options. We're not turning back. It reminds me of the young groom who had just gotten married, and he pledged to his wife, he says, I will never, ever leave you. I will never, ever divorce you. And the next day he went out and he bought 2 burial plots because he meant what he said. We're not turning back. It reminds me of the story of Christopher Reeves. You know the story years ago. He was an actor who was Superman in the movies and was at a career high at the time that he had an equestrian accident where his horse Buck stopped unexpectedly at a jump and threw Christopher Reeves over head first, all 6'3", 6'4" of him, and he lands on his head and he breaks his vertebrae. And he says he remembers being in the hospital and he was on a machine that was breathing for him, and his wife Dana comes up to him and he mouthed to her the words, maybe we should just let me go. Dana began crying. She said, I'm going to say this only once because the decision is yours. She says, you're still you, and I love you. Oh, that's commitment. If you know the story, she was there for the rest of his life. She meant what she said. You're still you, and I love you. He said, I knew then we would be together forever. We were family. Oh, Elton Trueblood says, family solidarity takes hard work, much imagination, and constant self-criticism on the part of all members. A successful marriage is not one in which 2 people beautifully match, find each other, and get along happily ever after. It is, instead, a means by which persons who are sinful and contentious are so caught by a dream bigger than themselves that they work throughout the years in spite of repeated disappointment to make the dream come true. Oh, what's the dream? Is the dream happiness? And I'm for happiness. I believe God for happiness. But I'm here to tell you, I think God is far more concerned about your holiness than your happiness. Oh, the dream for me has changed over the years. It's not about moving up the corporate ladder, the bigger house and that sort of thing anymore. My dream has become, and I believe God's design and God's intent in marriage is that you would dream to make a holy life together. That Wanda and I can make a holy life together. That I could help Wanda get to heaven. That's my dream. And I know it's her dream that she helped me. I'm here to tell you, if I make it, it will be because of Wanda. And her desire that we make a holy life together. If you'll bear with me a few more minutes, we'll do one more. See, if you want to make a holy life together, we need to talk about the change factor. That's just the way I am. I remember the story of a couple in Tallahassee, Florida, where I did a little counseling with Meridian Woods Church, and they came to me and they had been married for about 8 years, and they were at a tough spot in their relationship, and this is session one, and she's requesting change of him. You know what her request was? I'd like him to be more affectionate towards me, something we talked about in our Bible class. Oh, I wish he would be more affectionate towards me, and I'll never forget his response to her in that moment. She was requesting change. He looked over at her and he says, you know, you came from a family that's kind of close-knit and kind of touchy-feely. You guys are really affectionate and that's your family. I didn't come from that kind of family. My family's not very affectionate. He said, I wasn't particularly affectionate towards you before we got married. We've been married for 8 years. I haven't been particularly affectionate towards you during the 8 years. See, he knew it. It wasn't a knowledge issue. He says, I haven't been particularly affectionate towards you for 8 years. And then here's the punchline. You ready? He looks at her and says, I'm not very affectionate, and that's just the way I am. How about that? Session one. What would you say if you were the counselor, if you were the therapist? Oh, he was anchoring down. I'm not very affectionate. That's just the way I am. And if I remember correctly, I said something like this to him. Don't give me, that's just the way I am. As best I recall, God is the only I am being. The rest of us are called to become something other than what we are. Amen? We have too many bad marriages out there today because one or two people are saying, that's just the way I am. And so our brick for dealing with that, the change factor, that's just the way I am. Our brick has got to be a willingness to be transformed. I like Malachi 3:2-3, one of my favorite passages. But who can endure the day of His coming? Who can stand when He appears? For He will be like a refiner's fire, a launderer's soap. He will sit as a refiner and purifier of silver. He will purify the Levites and refine them like gold and silver. Then the Lord will have men who will bring offerings. What? In righteousness. In holiness. And I suggest to you that God is like a refining fire, a launderer's soap. How do you refine gold and silver? You place it in a crucible. That's what it was, a crucible. It was an instrument, a bowl, where you would put your gold or silver and you would subject it to an intense heat. And it would melt and the impurities would rise to the top and you would skim away the impurities. And that's how you refined gold and silver. And I'm here to suggest to you that marriage is God's crucible. It is a place of transformation, of being molded and shaped into a righteous and holy people if we're willing to be transformed. Scripture says, perseverance must finish its work so that you may be mature and complete, not lacking anything. Let us purify ourselves from everything that contaminates body and spirit. What? Perfecting holiness out of reverence for God. I love this quote. The state of marriage is one that requires more virtue and constancy than any other. In spite of the bitter nature of its juice, in spite of all the conflict, in spite of all the struggle, in spite of all the hardships and difficulties we might face, in spite of the bitter nature of its juice, you may be able to draw and make what? A holy life together. Oh, God rejoices when we can make a holy life together. I'm going to suggest to you, and in all honesty, we could spend an hour right here, but I will summarize it this way. To say, if you are selfish, God will use marriage to teach you to be unselfish. If you're selfish, God will use marriage to teach you to be benevolent. If you are controlling, God will use marriage to teach you to be submissive. If you're irresponsible, God will use marriage to teach you to be accountable, to be trustworthy. If you're uncaring, God will use marriage to teach you to be compassionate and kind. If you're disagreeable, God will use marriage to teach you how to be agreeable. If you're prideful, God will use marriage to teach you how to be humble. If you're stubborn, He'll teach you how to be yielding, how to be reasonable. If you're impatient, God will use marriage to teach you how to be accommodating, to be long-suffering. If you're unfair, God will teach you how to be impartial. Do you understand? We could spend more time here if we could. But God is all about molding us, shaping us, transforming us, and He will use the challenges, the difficulties, the crucible of marriage to transform us into a holy and righteous people. Watch this. If we are willing to be transformed. Oh, look at this quote. God worked in my life to change attitudes of bitterness, embarrassment, and resentment into attitudes of grace and love and hope. These new attitudes developed out of pain and self-sacrifice and a little creativity. God accomplished this by walking with me through the hard times I longed to control but could not, as I prayed and sought God's wisdom and courage. Oh, God worked in my life to transform attitudes, to transform behaviors. And so I would encourage you this week, have conversations this week regarding how you can make positive and, yes, specific changes in your own behavior, in your own attitude that would help the two of you have a relationship, watch this, cast in holiness and righteousness and which honors God's design and desire for marriage. Oh, are you willing to be transformed? Hey, I hope we've said something so far today that would maybe prompt you to walk away and say, I want to be transformed. I want to be willing to be change. That my marriage would be holy in the sight of God. That we would be a holy and righteous people. Oh, that's my prayer for you. If we can pray for you or help you in some way in that way today, we certainly invite you to come while we stand and while we sing.